Okay, next up is Daniel Vigil. Daniel manages the Marijuana Health Monitoring and Research Program at the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment. He's a preventive medicine physician who started in family medicine. He completed medical school residency and a master's in public health at the University of Colorado. He has worked at both local and state public health agencies and in public health clinics in diverse areas, including tobacco cessation, cardiovascular risk screening, infection control policy, oil and gas health effects, and marijuana. Here's Daniel.
All right, thank you, Hal. And good afternoon. So I'm going to share some marijuana surveillance data from Colorado. Most of you know that in 2013, Colorado voters approved a constitutional amendment to legalize recreational marijuana. And this really was a paradigm shift. So as many of you have experienced, even with advance notice, something like this can really lead to a scramble to get regulations and programs in place. So lawmakers quickly wrote some legislation, which included tasking the health department with appointing a panel of healthcare professionals and monitoring emerging science and medical information about potential health effects of marijuana and monitoring drug use patterns. So I want to just quickly talk about how we're applying those legislative requirements and then dive into data on marijuana use patterns, hospitalizations, emergency department visits, and poison center calls. So the panel of experts was convened and named the Retail Marijuana Public Health Advisory Committee. We have 13 members currently, including epidemiologists, public health experts, medical specialists in OBGYN, pediatrics, pulmonology, psychiatry, and emergency medicine, and a pharmacologist and a medical toxicologist. To monitor the emerging science, we had to, of course, start with an extensive review of existing literature. We are now doing ongoing updates and adding new topics. I put this in blue because this is part of what I'll specifically be addressing today. For monitoring changes in drug use patterns, we have some information from national surveys, like the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance Survey, the National Survey on Drug Use and Health, and eventually some information from PRAMS, the Pregnancy Risk Assessment Monitoring System. We also have specific state and local surveys, including our Healthy Kids Colorado survey, which is where we ask all of the YRBSS questions, as well as additional questions. We have a Colorado Child Health Survey, which is a callback survey for BRFSS respondents who report having children in the home. A WIC survey, women, infants, and children from one of our larger local health departments. And then a cannabis user survey that our program is conducting with CSTE funding. Thank you. For monitoring medical information, we look at Colorado Hospital Association data on hospitalizations and emergency department visits, and Rocky Mountain Poison and Drug Center data on calls involving marijuana. And we're starting a new project to look at death certificates with mention of marijuana and then the corresponding medical examiner and coroner's reports. This is a report that brings a lot of these things together, the results of our literature review and a lot of this surveillance data. Our first was published in January of 2015, and we'll be publishing updates every 2 years, but we actually online update chapters as we complete them. So if you Google either monitoring marijuana health or marijuana health Colorado, our program will be at the top of the search. So as we go through data, it'll be helpful to know the timeline of marijuana changes in Colorado. Medical marijuana was legalized in 2001. However, it couldn't be sold in dispensaries until 2010, and we call that the commercialization of medical marijuana. And then January of 2014 is when the recreational marijuana became legal. So let's jump into some data first about adult marijuana use. Now, this data is from BRFSS when Colorado in 2014 first added marijuana-related questions to our supplement. Approximately 13% of adults, depending on which age cutoff you use, report current use, which is defined as using at least once in the last 30 days. Among those current users, about a third report using daily, and almost 19% report driving after using. Now, we are improving that question to specify a time period after using for upcoming BRFSS. We don't have national information to compare it to because they don't have marijuana questions yet, although a CSTE subgroup is working on that. So, as I mentioned, we started in 2014 with these questions. We don't have data, therefore, from the BRFSS prior to that. And to date, we don't have state-level data from NISDA. So this is comparing across surveys, but it's worth at least taking a quick look at. You can see in 2010, the use among 18-year-olds and older was about 11.3% on NISDA, and it varied somewhat over the years. And then we have the 13.6 in 2014. Now, there's not a statistically significant change there. This is still from BRFSS, looking at more specific demographics. So men are more likely to currently use at 17.2% versus 10% for females. Current use decreases significantly with age, with almost 30% of the 18 to 24-year age group reporting current use. And it is lower among adults with at least some college education. However, ever use is higher among that group. Looking at income, current use is highest at 19.8% among those with a household income below $25,000. Use is higher among blacks, and then followed by whites, Hispanics, and other races. And gay, lesbian, and bisexual individuals have a likelihood of 30% of using. So moving on to the a Colorado-based survey, the Influential Factors in Healthy Living Survey, 48% of Colorado adults report ever having used, and median age at first use was 16.7 among those adults who said that they had used at some point. And about 20% of those individuals said that they had used in the past 30 days, or our definition of current use. So narrowing down to that group of users, we asked how that they were using, and this was a select all that apply. About 96% reported smoking, and close to half reported also using some form of ingested marijuana. We asked current users about how many times per month they used. Some of them, even though they reported current use, said that they used zero times. But it was approximately a third, a third, a third for less weekly or less versus several times a week versus daily or near daily use. So PRAMS first asked questions about marijuana in 2014. That data is not available yet. We do have a little bit of information about marijuana use in pregnancy, thanks to the Tri-County Health Department in Colorado and the survey that they did for the Women, Infants, and Children program. Now, of course, this is not highly generalizable to the overall public. It's a subpopulation. But in this group, and let me clarify, these were women who had recently given birth. So among them, those under 30 years and under, 7.4% reported current use, and that number was 4% for those over 30. Now, among those who were current users, 36% said that they did use during their pregnancy, and about 14% used while breastfeeding. The survey looked at reasons that new mothers reported using, and the highest was to help with depression, anxiety, and stress. Many also used it to help with pain, and then about half with nausea or vomiting. So moving on now to adolescent marijuana use. Most of our data is from the Healthy Kids Colorado survey. As I mentioned, that is our way of administering the YRBSS questions, as well as some additional questions. And you'll see here that we have a little bit of fluctuation from 2005 to 2015. The survey is given every 2 years in both ever use and current use among high school students. And in particular, in 2015, the estimates from Healthy Kids Colorado and nationally from YRBSS are nearly identical, both for ever use at around 38% and current use at around 21% of high school students. This looks at high school and middle school students by grade, and not surprisingly, there is an increase as you go up in grade level. It is statistically significant from 9th to 10th grade and from 10th to 11th grade. In addition, the dark green bar is 2013 data, the light green bar is 2015 data, and the only significant difference that we had there was for 11th graders, and it did significantly increase. Now, there's a little bit of contrast here. The NISDA data for past 30-day marijuana use, different cut of ages here, 12 to 17 years, they found that use among Colorado adolescents of those ages was significantly higher than use nationally. And it's a little bit difficult to compare because of the different cuts. However, when we try to think about this difference, the NISDA survey is able to reach about 400 individuals in this age range in Colorado, whereas our Healthy Kids Colorado survey reaches over 16,000. So this is back to high school students only, male and female use, and while female use was lower in 2013 than male use, they're nearly identical in 2015. These are age of first marijuana use among high school seniors who report using. And what's really significant here is the big jump around the 13 to 14 age group. Big lesson there is that that's the time that we need to be reaching adolescents. This is information on usual methods of use. So this was not a choose all that apply. It was please tell us your one usual method. And by far, the most common method is smoking. Edibles from 2013 in the light blue to 2015 in the green did see a statistically significant decrease. So one big question that we had was, okay, overall use in the last 30 days may not be significantly changing, but what about the amount that teens are using? This looks at that, and we're happy to see that among the 40 or more times per month and the 20 to 39 times per month, we're not really seeing an increase. In fact, you know, most of these are fairly stable. This is from the Colorado Child Health Survey, which, as I mentioned, is a callback survey from BRFSS. And so of parents with children in their homes, about 7% reported having marijuana in or around the home. And then about 4% of children were in homes where marijuana was used inside. Among those who had it in the home, 71% said that they did keep it locked away. So then on the right-hand side, of parents who used marijuana inside the home, 76% said that they smoked it, 38% vaporized, and 14% ate it. And this was a choose all that apply. So finally, trying to get a sense of potential health impact. This is still sort of high level, just looking at actual emergency department visits and hospitalizations and poison center calls. You'll see, now we didn't have data for emergency department visits until 2014, which is in the green, 2011. And from that time, it has trended up year by year. Hospitalization similarly trended up during that time and was generally stable before that time. So you might recall that what we're calling the commercialization of medical marijuana, where you could actually get it at dispensaries, began in 2010. That may be related to these increases. This just collapses into those eras of prior to any legalization, then when medical marijuana was legalized but not commercially available. The third set is medical marijuana commercialization, and finally then retail marijuana legalization. And you see there's a statistically significant increase after retail legalization as well. I think I probably need to try to move a little bit faster. So this is poison center call volume among different age groups, and it increases in 2013 and 2014, especially among the orange, which is those over 25 years of age, and in the green, which is the 0 to 8 year age group. This is the same graph that we saw a minute ago, only for just children 0 to 8, and the numbers are quite low, but there is some increase. Different thing that was really interesting to look at was emergency department visits among Colorado residents versus out-of-state residents. And this is, I believe, in publication right now. But we're working hard to do some educational outreach to tourists. So, finally, as I mentioned, that's kind of high-level data right now. Of course, there are a lot of limitations to using hospitalization and emergency department data, and we're trying to begin some projects to tease some more things out. We looked at major diagnostic categories and found that mental illness had a much higher prevalence ratio for being connected with marijuana codes in both emergency department visits, which this shows, and hospitalizations. So take-home messages. The available data don't really suggest a substantial increase in current marijuana use in Colorado, adults or youth. There is higher current use among Colorado adults compared to most other states, but that has actually been the case for many years. There's conflicting data on current use among Colorado youth, and it'd be important to try to figure out a little bit more why that is. There's higher current use among certain demographics. Methods of use show mostly smoking with co-use of other methods. There is a substantial possibility for child exposure through secondhand smoke and edibles used in the home. And then finally, we have seen increases in healthcare encounters due to marijuana. That's all. Thank you.
Okay, we've got time for questions. We've got a microphone up here, unless you can speak really loud. Just let us know who your question's for.
Lower now. So my question is for you, and it's a two-part question. The first one is, and throughout the presentation, the thing that I wondered was, what is the cost of marijuana in Colorado? What is the range and such? And so, because you also mentioned that those who are households, I think it was less than $25,000, had higher, I don't want to say rate, but had a higher usage, it appeared. And then the other piece of that is, as I was looking at your bar graphs, prior to the medical marijuana being released medical marijuana, and then again when it became retail, prior to that, there were no emergency room visits, it appeared on the, and that seems rather odd, I'd say, because I would think that there would still be visits prior to, but obviously more people might be coming because they won't be go to jail for it. So I was wondering if you could talk about both of those pieces together, please.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, so I'll answer the last one first. We didn't collect data on emergency department visits prior to 2011. So it wasn't that they weren't happening. As far as cost, I don't remember the exact tax amounts that Colorado has, nor what exactly things cost. But I anecdotally have certainly heard that people are able to come to Colorado, buy marijuana at retail stores, take it out of state, unfortunately, and sell it for a profit. So that would indicate to me that it's lower than typical street value at these stores. And
do you have any comparability between it and like alcohol?
I don't, but that's a really interesting question. That's something that.
Yeah, well, for one would help, but also just the fact that you know how much it is to buy a fifth of vodka versus the cost of marijuana.
Mm-hmm. Right. I haven't looked into that, and that's a really interesting question because it could suggest, you know, changing patterns of substance use overall. We should find out about that. Thanks. Did I miss any other part of the question? Okay.
May I ask what medical condition or what symptoms which prompted the people end up using marijuana going to the ER?
So I think some of the top symptoms for people going to the ER with marijuana use are gastrointestinal disruption, psychotic type of symptoms, some of the mental health connected in that analysis that we did, things like depression and anxiety. The first two that I mentioned, we are aware of those as acute effects. The connection with something like depression or anxiety may or may not be an acute effect. It may be that those individuals are more likely to be using marijuana. That's things that we still need to try to sort out.
For the last speaker, and I apologize if you talked about this at the beginning of your presentation. I came in a little bit late. I was wondering if you had looked at all at use of marijuana along with alcohol or other drugs, and if that has changed since legalization.
I know that some people are taking a look at that. I haven't personally looked closely at that data, so I'm sorry, I don't.
Um,
Do you have a sense of how your rates of marijuana-related emergency department visits compared to other drugs?
It's definitely higher, and I have seen those numbers at some point. I can't quote specifically, but we're definitely talking in multiple fold higher at this point.
Don't be shy, Patrick.
Hi, I have a question for Daphna. I was just wondering, that report that you released, it created such an interesting dialogue in social media, and I guess...
That's not a report.
Oh, it's not there? Oh.
No, there was a bio-science report that came out like January of this year, and it created a lot of buzz.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because the messaging about the recommendation for women and whether some groups of women felt discouraged or unempowered to take responsibility on their own alcohol consumption practices and their own health. This report is actually different. That didn't even create much of a buzz.
Oh, okay.
But it's from the same group. I collaborated on this study. Mm-hmm. That study was actually is a separate study.
Oh, okay. I guess I was just like wondering if there are any kind of like lessons learned from that incident and how like CDC is going to talk about like alcohol and reproductive health in the future.
Yeah, that's a great question, and I think we're still on a learning curve on that one. Personally, the alcohol program, we are part of the Chronic Disease Center. We work in collaboration with the Fetal Alcohol Syndrome Program, which is out of the Birth Defect Center. And they are specifically targeting population of women of reproductive age or childbearing age because their messages are about to prevent fetal alcohol syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
My program actually looking at excessive alcohol use across the lifespan.
Mm-hmm.
We don't really try to just identify one high-risk group. We're trying to address the entire spectrum of alcohol consumption across the lifespan because we find it to really be prevalent across the lifespan. The umbrella term of excessive drinking also include women who are pregnant should not drink at all. So it's a very tricky place to go to because as much as women want to behave like men, have the same equal rights and responsibilities as men, they also tend to drink now like men, which is not so healthy.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the problem is also the issue with the industry pumping a lot of marketing to women in ways that are so strong and making drinking like, you know, you can achieve better and you can look younger and thinner and healthier and more socially acceptable if you drink. So the messages that we get through marketing is making women actually increase consumption because generally women tend to drink less than men.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to excessive drinking, women are actually, and especially young professional women who have enough disposable income, tend to drink as much as men. And nobody will argue that excessive drinking is healthy to anyone, women or men.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Sure, thank you.
I'm back. So my question, this is for Laura, and I will disclose that we've worked together a little bit regarding New Mexico, so I'll put that out there to begin with, so I understand what's going on in New Mexico regarding alcohol. But in this sense, you talked about diabetes, so I'm going to expand it to alcohol in general in New Mexico, and it was nice to see that you mentioned the USPSTF, which is the Preventive Services Task Force recommendation, that's a B, regarding individual assessments, clinicians, and also Daphne, in your presentation, you had what the community guy had as far as, and those are more population-based. So it was sort of nice to see population level, individual level, but I wanted to focus in on the specific individual levels because you talked about potentially going out and doing education. And so also with knowing what's going on in New Mexico, as you mentioned on Sunday at the pre-conference workshop regarding alcohol is a very large issue. in New Mexico. If you could, and this is not a trick question, but it might be put you on the spot as far as from a state perspective, because the question essentially is, so education is helpful for clinicians, but whereas the population the population point is you can regulate both at the county level and at the state level on how on dram shop liability and other things like that. So what would you sort of going beyond the just education to get clinicians really involved in actually assessing their risk for their patients' risk for alcohol, because we know clinicians have very limited time in general, and to ask anything about sexual activity, they do usually ask about alcohol, smoking, et cetera. So just sort of what do you think that you might be able to do within the state as a state level with clinicians? Thank you.
So yes, Patrick is correct. Alcohol is a big issue in New Mexico. We are the leading cause of alcohol-related deaths in the nation. We're the leading cause. We are not the cause. Yeah, New Mexico has the highest rate of alcohol-related deaths by far. Alaska used to be neck and neck in us, and not anymore. And so your question has a number of facets. One, you did catch me out a little bit, and then I have a sneaky agenda. And since we're all friends in the room, we're all epidemiologists, part of me, I break my job down into sort of doing outreach into groups and trying to sort of find the in. The chink in the wall of like where alcohol may have a, because I mean, you know, if I'm going to be honest with y'all, alcohol impacts every community in New Mexico. I mean, I can find a presentation like that for almost any condition, demographic group, and I can find a way that alcohol has impacted that community. And so frequently I will do analyses like this to sort of not drum up support, but sort of build coalition, build community, and to kind of raise awareness of the issues of alcohol in our state. This was an important thing that came up when I, you know, kind of looked at the alcohol screening and brief intervention questions by other conditions and by demographics. This one popped up and was concerning. And so, you know, and that was kind of where this analysis sort of came out of. But answer your question, like one, this is these sort of exercises, I mean, this not exercises, but you know, this sort of epidemiology kind of translating this into a larger, broader audience and an audience that's a little bit different from substance abuse kind of helps me sort of talk to them about like other coalition building, other measures, other more environmental based prevention. For example, like you said, looking at alcohol outlet density, about dram shop liability, so that then when they hear about that through other sources, they're like, oh, I know what that is, and it's a great thing, and we should totally do that. You know, we should totally reduce alcohol outlet density, and we should totally increase dram shop liability, and the dreadful T word that I'm not allowed to say. And so, you know, So that's one thing. It's to kind of just sort of like get everyone on the same page, regardless of like what group they're with. And then I think also to what you were, the more specific question of like getting people educated around alcohol screening and brief prevention. Honestly, I think getting them paid is probably my first priority. Medicaid in New Mexico will not cover alcohol screening and brief intervention for reasons that are unclear to me. So when ACA passed, ACA said you have to pay, if you expand Medicaid, you have to pay for all A and B USPSTF recommended services. And alcohol screening and brief intervention is in there. And so I'm confused as to why we're not paying for it. So that's kind of first priority, is getting it paid. A lot of physicians actually know about alcohol screening and brief intervention as a concept, but they're kind of clear on the specifics of how they should do it. So we're working right now on trying to get like a little card that they can keep in their office that would sort of tell them like the one, you know, the this is, here are the audit questions, here are the audit T questions, here's the one screener binge, which are the three that are recommended by USPSTF, and then, you know, brief intervention sort of can include these things, and then for further resources and training, then here are some links. That was a long answer. I'm so sorry.
I have a question, I guess for Daphne or for whomever. So is there any messaging on safe drinking or healthy drinking? It, like, coming from the drug side, like, we're just, like, not allowed to do that. But since alcohol is, like, legal, it's always been really interesting to me, especially, well, for lots of reasons. So,
yes, thank you. That's a really good question, because I have to first disclaim we are trying to prevent excessive drinking, not start with talking about any prohibition. It's not like illegal drug use, because it's illegal. It's legal to drink alcohol
right.
in certain age if you're 21 and older. But certain groups should not even drink because it's not healthy for them. So it's more like the disclaimer of who are you in terms of which groups are you falling under. But the U.S. Dietary Guidelines to Americans that was just released recently, the new version for 2015-2020, recommend that if you drink, if you choose to drink, you don't have to drink. It's not going to increase your health. There are no health benefits
right.
with drinking. But if you choose to drink, drink in moderation. And moderate drinking, defined in the dietary guideline, is up to one drink a day for a woman and up to two drinks a day for men.
Right.
So you have to make your own calculation given your underlying condition, chronic and other condition, underlying medication you're taking, because a lot of medication interact with alcohol. And what is your current status in terms of pregnancy or other things, whether it's healthy for you to drink. If you're in a health condition, you have a health condition, you should not drink at all. But if you drink and you choose to drink, drink in moderation.
Because I think the issue is, like, you know, you leave it open for the industry to, like, do fake harm reduction messaging. And I just think that there should be, like, a governmental, because it does come off as, even though it's not intended to be prohibitionist, it is, but, like, by never, like, just owning that message, that it's okay, you know, to have a glass of wine. And so then you get that messaging from industry, drink in moderation, be careful with, you know, but it's really not about
yeah.
that.
Yeah, we looked at a different study, which we collaborated with the Division of Cancer Prevention and Control at CDC, and we looked at BRFSS data, and we look at those who are reporting in BRFSS, they're drinking according to the dietary guidelines. Two-thirds are of the population in the U.S. drink in exceeding dietary guidelines. So 67% of adults who drink exceed the dietary guidelines.